Counselor Debbie Zubak.
Counselor Mike Kapanen.
We got Carly up.
Acting Clerk Administrator Carly Britton.
I'm John Jackson, a consulting planner to assist the municipality.
And Mayor David Morton. In the spirit of reconciliation and cooperation, we wish to acknowledge that the land on which we gather is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and the Mississauga people. Its boundaries fall within the Robinson-Huron Treaty of 1850 and the Williams Treaty of 1923. We are grateful to live here, and we thank all the generations of people who have taken care of this land for thousands of years. We honor the suffering of Indigenous people and the love and wisdom they have carried for thousands of years. We pledge to work in community and harmony with each other and the environment we inhabit, and work towards true reconciliation. The purpose of the proposed zoning bylaw is to update the existing comprehensive zoning bylaw for the whole of the township of McKellar, and the proposed official plan amendment makes a number of technical changes to McKellar's official plan. There's a little bit of history before we turn it over to our planner. Back in 1873, no, I won't go back that far. Just in case you're a little worried with it. Make it comfortable. Previous council, I believe it's the previous one, rescinded a couple of resolutions. Much work was done already, almost to the stage we're at now. They rescinded the third reading of the official plan, I think it was OPA 9, and also the newer zoning bylaw. And so we're back to, I wouldn't say square one, but a lot of the work had been done. It's just that it was all put on hold, so the township reverted back to official plan, I guess with Amendment 8, and it was 2018. It might have been, John will correct, because it's a more recent date. And the zoning went back to 1995-12 instead of 2019-23. So what we're attempting to do is actually amend, update. We don't want to stick necessarily with 95-12. That's going way back. Much work was done, as I said, to bring it up to 2019. There were changes made in the approach. And what we ran into, the reason for the third reading, I think, was rescinded, was a result of a number of appeals that came with the changes that were suggested. Municipal Affairs also, the approval agency, so they had a number of comments. Different ministries, in particular the Ministry of Natural Resources, had a number of comments as well. And so what we tried to do was actually put out some RFPs to see if there was any interest in updating what we had already. We thought a lot of the work had been done, as I mentioned. The RFPs came in. They averaged, there were four of them, they averaged around $100,000 each to just update what we were looking at. So I think some of them were actually looking at a new official plan and a new zoning bylaw rather than an updating. One actually committed $200,000. So that was a little rich for our township, we thought. And we thought then, what else are we going to do here? And it was just a stab in the dark, I guess, but we weren't thinking that, I don't know, we had to go to Florida, did we? No, we just phoned you, I guess. And we went back to the original author of our documents back in from 1990, the official plan of the zoning, John Jackson. And he had left the service of the municipality a little time before that, but he did agree to come back. And who has more knowledge than he does about what we have available? He wrote the document. And so this is why we've gone to John then to update. I think initially he thought that since much of the work had been done, he could talk to Municipal Affairs and maybe shorten the 90-day period that's required by legislation. And I can let John speak to that as well. That's why these meetings were called the open house and the public meeting. They're not the statutory ones, because Municipal Affairs said they need the 90 days, in which case we're looking at September, October probably for the official, the legislated public meeting. But we got thinking, well, we might as well carry on with this while we're at it, so the public, especially the summer residents who may not be here later in the year, although Zoom is always available. And I should reference that we have an active Zoom, so people can comment live. It's not streamed in the sense that they can't participate. They can. A couple of municipalities have gone the other way now, and you can watch what goes on, but you can't make some suggestions. We went through the appeals, tried to incorporate some of those in the new documents or the updated documents. We looked at the Ministry of Natural Resources in particular. They were one of the ministries who had quite a few comments, and municipal affairs as well, and the appeals. And we tried to deal with all of those too in this particular document, the zoning and the official plan. So hopefully we covered many of those things. But of course, as you do that, then other issues might arise. The other thing we asked John to do, and he did it, true soldier that he is, we asked him to look at Whitestones. He was still working for Whitestone up until recently, and theirs was a little more recent than ours, and there were some things in there that seemed to apply or should apply to our township as well. So there were a number of comments from Whitestone that were actually included, and along the way, of course, there may be some typos and some little things where it didn't actually coordinate, and I think that's, I'll let John speak to that too, how we're going to finish this up with your comments as well, and municipal affairs, as I said before, the approval authority will have to get their comments as well, and then hold the statutory public meeting. But I'll turn it over to John to just run through some of the major changes. We don't think there are that many. There seem to be a lot of crossouts, a lot of redlining, but if you look at the philosophy behind what John is doing, then you'll see maybe why. Maybe not as drastic as you might think when you first look at it. So John, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, McMurr, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's nice to see a good turnout, as we also enjoyed on Sunday, where there are probably close to 100 between those in person and those that were attending electronically. Just by way of sort of a 101 planning understanding, when land use planning is done in municipalities, it must be consistent with the provincial policies which lead the municipal planning decisions in every way. So we must be following their policies to ensure that we are consistent with those policies. And that's one of the things that Reed Moore emphasized, and that was that when we were trying to implement the former updated zoning bylaw, we found there were some technical issues that we needed to address in the policy, and that ended up this one better.
It's not that quite very well.
This may be better. It needed a tweaking, if you like, with respect to a number of policies. And because McKellar does not have official plan approval status, we are dependent upon the province to undertake those approvals. And we're hoping that at the end of this exercise, we will get that autonomy, which I'm certain we will. But what the province did 4 or 5 years ago, sort of mid-COVID, was said, well, we want you to add these 10 items to your technical changes, and that introduced a number of those areas which were required to be put in place to recognize the most recent provincial policy statement. So it expanded a program that wasn't intentional, but here we are. One of the rules in the province, as David alluded to, was that they required 90 days to review your proposed policy changes. I tried to emphasize, well, we're not changing anything from the 4 or 5 year exercise in 2019, but they decided, no, we want a further review, even though we're not under a new provincial policy regime, which comes into effect in October of 2024 this year, most of which changes relate to the housing crisis that, well, we as McKellarites share in the issue. There's not much we do as a cottage country or a rural municipality in that regard, so there aren't a lot of changes in that area. So what we're hoping to do is take advantage of the work that was done, again, tweaking it. The information was put online in a fairly comprehensive set of documents which I'm sure many of you looked at. So this exercise, as was Sunday's, is to get any further questions answered or submissions. So this is more or less your meeting. We've had working sessions through the summer. We've had submissions. We have further written submissions tonight, and we will take those back. And as Reeve Moore said, we're going to end up having to repeat this meeting after the 90-day period, which is the end of September. In terms of the highlights, one or two of these highlights are that we had to follow new legislation, efforts to respond to things like the housing crisis, includes adding opportunities for secondary dwellings on properties. That does not apply to lakefront properties, but only non-lakefront, because the province recognizes lake communities as one parcel, one dwelling. We do have a number of technical changes to things like bed and breakfasts or natural heritage policies, many of which are probably reduced in status by saying we are going to follow the rules the province set out for those kinds of things, so we don't need to parrot them. So we're actually shortening the document. There's been a new revelation with respect to how development affects lakes in terms of environmental impact. We are using now a more streamlined approach to best management practices to preserve the water the water qualities of McKellar's 21 lakes. I think that the standards have very few changes, so they're the same as they've been for the past 30 years, with some minor exceptions. One is we've increased the rural lot standard from 1 acre to 2 acre. 2 acres to recognize possible contamination from wells and septics. There are some setback improvements. We're allowing slightly larger bunkies or sleeping cabins from 35 square meters to 50 square meters, which are 400 now going to 550 square feet. So there are some benefits in those areas, and those are all detailed in the document. So they're welcoming questions. We'll take those and work on them. One of the issues that actually came forward on Sunday, which was more or less part of a land use concern, and that was short-term rentals. We've set it up that mechanically our bylaws can deal with whatever approach council would like to respond to, whether the it's kept the same where they're considered commercial uses or whether they're licensed or whether they can be site-specifically zoned. No decision's been made because we're still getting submissions on that. So this is a meeting that we're offering your submissions, and we'll take those where we can't come up with responses tonight, and we will get answers to them. Or if we have the ability to answer those questions, we'll answer them. So I'm going to turn it back over to our Mayor Moore and let the proceedings begin.
Great. Thanks, John. Yeah, the way we'll proceed, just as we did on Sunday, I think the people who actually came out tonight can speak first. We'll save the Zoom people up for later. And we'd ask that you come up to the microphone and actually give your name. And we have a recording secretary in behind, our deputy acting clerk administrator, Carly. I think she'll keep track of everybody. So I'd ask you to come up, and if you have a number of people, some people have already commented on this, you're representing a number of people, which is better, so we don't have five people speaking on the same topic, unless it's new information, that we can have maybe one person or two people represent those people. That would be useful. There's no particular order. We'll just... as people want to come up and give their name, that's great. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. It's on.
Just push it to the right, comes on.
It's on now?
Yeah.
I see the zoning map posted on the wall. Are these the most up?
Sunday, Reg, we've got a list of some additional changes from people's review, but those plus the changes that are going to be made reflect sort of the current status.
Okay, the only comment I have on them is I think they need to be looked at pretty close because the previous 95-12 maps, as amended, had a lot of site-specific zonings on them, and the number is 70-some. And they have all been taken out in the new bylaws, so if the maps don't reflect those boundaries, how is the chief building official going to know how he's issued permits? And I can tell you right now, I'm looking at just quickly looking at those maps, they do not reflect those boundaries or the zoning applicable to them.
We can check
5 minutes to walk in and look at them and tell that.
We can go over them again, but I think that referring to what were normally site-specific provisions for past bylaw amendments, some of those were essentially no longer necessary, but where they continue to reflect a need to be recognized, we'll check that again.
I'll leave it there for Russell Carrillon forever. All I can say is I don't agree they're not necessary. Just because they've been acted on doesn't mean they're not necessary.
Just one thing on that. I think what John was saying, he can correct me on this, he's the planner. It may not say exception on there. I'm not sure on the maps does it say exception. It used to say SP and then it would give a number.
Yeah, the exceptions are there.
They are there? Okay, and some, I think what he's saying is some of them are no longer exceptions. That was a result of a lot of the appeals. But we've gone back through those and there's still some that have been moved from an exception to an actual zoning. And maybe those are the ones you're referring to. But
I see one on there that says waterfront. That's a very recent rezoning and it shouldn't be waterfront.
Okay, if we have specifics, that would be useful, yeah.
Pardon?
If we actually knew that would help us an awful lot too, which one you're referring to. But.
Yeah, I don't want to be specific. User going through the process, so
okay.
It should be final in the end. It should be complete.
Yeah. I agree.
If I give you a list and then I miss something on the list, is that my fault?
No. You're just helping out the community.
You're the ones that are going through the exercise. It should be complete.
You're helping
professional planner.
You're helping the community, but you decide.
I think I am, and I have been quite a bit.
Okay.
John mentioned that there was some minor changes because the provincial policy statement permitted a second dwelling. He mentioned that the township was increasing the lot size in the rural areas. I didn't hear any mention of increasing the number of lots permitted through consent in the rural area.
Yeah, that was one of the areas where the rules have gotten a little less restrictive. Just backstory on that for people. The policy previously allowed the creation of up to 3 new waterfront lots. But the rural policy limited to 2 new lots in the rural area, and we thought, why not be consistent? So that's a change that was made. Thank you, Ken.
Is there any studies around that support that?
I think if I would respond to that, it's more of a principle of being consistent. There was no real reason for not having the same policy applied to all lands. Land was land, and you got to keep in mind many of those historical policies were tampered with by the province, and that was something that were give and take to get on, if you could describe it that way. So, thank you.
So on Sunday, I'd asked a question about the word generally and intent and things like that, and you give me an answer, a planning answer. That policy to allow more than 2 lots. It says generally, and it includes the waterfront. So again, what does that mean generally? Could there be instances where somebody may not get the 3 lots, or maybe somebody will get 4 or 5 lots?
And in fact, the legislation has no number in it. When we were passed a law on the responsibility for setting a policy, it was recognized there was no number, but it was the province that said, we would not want you to allow more than 2 or 3. But because there's no number,
And planning has a dynamic which is primarily founded on reasonable and rational logic. You could go to four, or you might find that three in a certain instance wasn't applicable. So I call that generally to make the document more more reasonable and logical.
I think that is a term that should not be used. It makes it gray for anybody making the decision and for somebody applying. And in my experience, gray is not good. And I think there's people can probably here tonight that can speak to that too. Whenever they're doing something, they want to know what the rules are. They don't want somebody coming along halfway through and say, no, sir, you can't do that.
I think I might have, if I can through your worship, gave a background to the difference between policy and legislation. Official plans are policy, which are languages that are intended to reach some objective or goal. And they're to be interpreted somewhat liberally in contrast to legislation, like a zoning bylaw is a statute. And statutes, by their very nature, are black and white. So there's a line. You're either one side or another. They're kind of dumb in that regard. But those are definite. Those are black and whites. But most planning policy documents have to be gray to really have proper meaning, and that's established by some very high-level court decisions. So it's directed, that's the dynamic that should exist with planning. They don't have that liberty in zoning because you're either on one side of the number or on the other. So it can be black and white. But there is a distinction between the two instruments, and that's pretty common in planning.
Well, that leads me into another question. The zoning bylaw is applicable at the township level. The official plan is applicable when it comes to the planning board making decisions on creating property. So those policies, are they going to be looked at the planning back or at the planning board and interpreted as it may be three, it may be two, it may be four? And the planning board does look at official plan policies in order to create property. You know that very well.
And again, I think it comes back to understanding that every circumstance has to be looked at with respect to its own merits and what particular issues might emerge in that regard. And you have to be consistent not only with your policies but with the province's policies, but you have to adhere to the statute, which is the zoning bylaw. And in many instances, a consent that is logical but yet defies zoning often has a condition that you change that zoning to implement it. So you have to understand planning is not simply a set of rules, it's a set of circumstances.
Okay. Did I touch on about the second dwelling? Person, the second dwelling?
Not yet.
I don't think you were really clear on that. I guess there's nothing wrong with putting a policy in there whenever the provincial policy talks about it. But it isn't applicable in McKellar because the second dwelling is only permitted in a farm use, which it always has been, depending on the area and everything else. And it's not permitted in a rural zone because of the new legislation, the new provincial policy statement, because you have to be on municipal water and sewer, do you not?
No. That's incorrect, but...
Well, I don't know what I read then.
The Planning Act says quite clearly that a municipality cannot pass a zoning restriction that wouldn't allow a secondary dwelling. A secondary dwelling is like a basement apartment or an apartment in an accessory structure like a garage. What we found in most private service communities like McKellar, where we don't have urban services, most septic systems were built and they were not oversized. So if you had a three or four bedroom home, you didn't put a system in for six bedrooms. So the reality is, unless you upgrade a septic system at great expense, you're not going to qualify for that second dwelling. But we can't, because because of the planning legislation that exists today, say that you can't have a secondary dwelling. We must say you can have one. What we say is you can have one in the rural areas, but you must comply with, obviously, code requirements for servicing.
And the zoning bylaw says that?
Well, in combination with other legislation, yes.
You're always welcome to a round two, but anybody else? Just need your name first.
Ariel Jones, and I would like my property, concession 1123, changed from waterfront to rural. I don't know why it was waterfront ever. It's not touching on water. The rest of it is okay.
Well, yeah, we'll look at that mural for sure, because that's supposed to be a fact. And if you're right, which I know you are, we're going to correct that.
Okay, thank you.
Is the policy still in the plan? Any property that's within 150 meters of the water is waterfront, and nothing beyond that can be rural?
That's not quite the policy. The policy is that the lands that functionally front on waterfront are considered waterfront. There is a guideline that says usually that is an area of a band around the lake that's 150 meters, but you could be 300 meters and still be a waterfront lot. So it depends, as long as you have a continuous ownership down to a water's edge, that would all be considered functionally part of the lakefront property.
I think there's more gray there. Is it 150 or 300? Or is it one parcel, or if it's two different parcels of land that can change?
No, it doesn't do that, the sort of segregation that you're speaking of. What we're talking about is the land functionally on the lake? And so it's more important than saying, is it with 150 meters, because that goes back to the intent of the policy, and that intent is clearly, does it function as a waterfront property? You might be 50 meters and not be on the water, such as on Lakeshore Road, for example.
I'm not sure that answered my question, but anyway.
I guess one of the problems is, like, even to define functional. I mean, who makes that interpretation? I guess that's, I'll put you on the spot with that one.
I think it's essentially, is the property focused on the lake as a property? We make an exception that obviously farm usage, agricultural uses can go right down to the lake, but in most cases, is that property that you're looking at that's adjoining or adjacent to a water body, is it functional in terms of its use and its occupation as far as the waterfront? So it's a combination of the physical distance, but secondary to its actual function. That's how planners understand that.
I think it would be much clearer if it was just 150 meters or one ownership.
And then I think you're missing the point.
Pardon?
I think you're missing the point then.
Good evening. My name is Debbie Sweetman, and I have a question that I don't know the answer to. Was there at one time a cap on the number of lots, waterfront lots, there could be on Manitowabi?
Actually, there was. In the early days of the preparation of the charter policy, the cap was decided that I'm gonna somewhat by recollection, I think it was around 1,100 cottages on Manitowabi.
And what do we have now?
I think it's somewhere between 1,000 and 1,100.
Okay.
But what we decided to do historically was bump up the standard of lot size rather than be a slave to some arbitrary number. So much of the lake has been elevated from the really old days of, I think it was 45 meter frontages. It jumped to 60, and now the majority of the lake, at least the east side, is 90 meters. So it went from 150 to 200 to 300. And that was felt to be a more manageable approach rather than pegging an arbitrary number.
Okay. So there are large parcels on the lake that could still be divided according to those standards, putting more boats and everything on the lake?
A few. Over the years, much of the lake development potential has been exercised, but I'll say a few for sure.
Yeah. I just see a difference. We've been here like 50 years, and now there's like a zillion boats, et cetera, right? So they're not kind of capping the number of lots allowed on the lake. They're just saying, okay, it has to be.
No, in fact,
100 feet or whatever.
2011, 12-ish, McKellar Council undertook a boat capacity program where it evaluated Ventwaving and McKellar, and there wasn't a lot of support for saying there should be a cap. And the notion was that it was a self-fulfilling regulation, that if the lake was too busy, you wouldn't go skiing that day. And that was kind of like pushed back on, and that's where we ended up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there is not a cap currently. It's just
no, you're right.
Okay. Also, I know that there's some properties, and they have, I guess they lease 30-foot waterfrontage with docks and stuff like that. Nothing about that, right?
Are you asking, can that be done, or is that?
Oh, I think it's in the works. I think there is that done. I'm a realtor, so I see it on the MLS, right?
I think so. I need some specifics because I'm not aware of that.
Okay,
issue.
I don't mean to round anybody out, but yeah, I just wondered how that worked. Another thing that you were talking about was the short-term rentals. And you said, I think that's what we're talking about, site-specific. So would that be, say, on our road, okay, that one's allowed to be a rental, and that one's not allowed to be a rental? Is that, and I wasn't clear. Like, you would rezone that one property on that road to be site-specific for a rental?
Just by way of background, right now, anything rented for less than 28 days is deemed to be a commercial use. Airbnb.
It's an illegal use of the land, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of interest out there in not being unlawful. So there's some support for allowing them in some fashion. Council has not made a decision. So
yeah.
Right now, they're unlawful.
Yes, they are.
So they're considering two options. Similar to Whitestone, they license short-term rentals. You pay an annual fee.
Right.
You have to go through all the rules and get a license. One of the points of discussion was, and most of the issues surrounding short-term rentals are behavioral issues. Trespass, fire, noise, parking, dogs. And so the thought was, what we could do is allow them to be zoned temporarily from residential to commercial.
Annually? With a license? Is that what you mean?
Well, no, just with a permission for a year. And if you do not generate those behavioral problems, you could get a renewal. So that was a second option that council has discussed. But right now, they're unlocked.
So basically, it's a license to lease your property renewed annually. It's not a site-specific zoning? Is that what you're saying?
The last one was site-specific zoning for the temporary period. the penultimate one, or the one before that, that option is like Whitestone, who licensed them annually. So if you want to rent your dwelling, you have to go to the municipality, pay $500, and observe all of the rules.
Okay, and then, you know, like, then would that specific property pay a commercial tax rate, or would they still pay a residential tax rate?
I don't think it would trigger a commercial categorization by MPAC. That's my experience.
Right. But I know that, you know, the people that are running businesses and are zoned for that, specifically Glenwood, probably Candlelight or whatever, they pay a higher tax rate, and that's a business. So now you're making a residential property with residential tax rates, and they're allowed to run a business. It's just
that,
a comment.
No, that argument's been made that the playing field's not level for those that are commercial. They tend not to be as significant as other issues, and it's more about control.
Yeah.
So,
and I know there's a lot of people that, you know, lend it to friends and family, rent or whatever. You know, I don't think a lot of people have an issue with people doing that. Or say, what about if you rented it for under 21 or 28 days throughout a year, then. Like,
well, what we did in the yet to be triggered option is said you get a free 2 weeks for friends and family. So
okay.
That's the definition.
Yep.
That's just copying Whitestone.
Yeah. And some people I know, some people it helps them with paying their taxes or whatever.
Sure.
And it's probably somebody they know because they're not clearing out all their stuff. And it's not like someone where you bought your cottage for personal use. Have your grandkids there. You don't feel like you have to lock everything up because you have a new person every single weekend beside you. Which is, you bought in an area zoned that it wasn't allowed. I know that some part on the lake, McDougall allows rentals, do they not?
No.
Oh, they don't?
No.
I thought there was some.
No, the only one in our area would be Whitestone. Carling does not, McDougall does not. Seguin doesn't, but tongue-in-cheek, some of those rentals are $100,000 a week. And so we're talking about a different culture there.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, if somebody was renting, because we all know how it goes, it's they rent, say, six people, 12 show up, septic. Hopefully it gets, like, those things would have to be looked at because, you know, we have E. coli issues. Don't know what the front, but thank you.
Which introduces my thought here from this person's last comment about septics. My name is Douglas Hunt, Plainview Garden Bureau. Earlier, the planner indicated that if you're a resident, residential building, you would be allowed to have a second residence within that building, rental with the basement, rental with the attic. But that residence would have to upgrade its septic system to accommodate the two-bedroom house, which would likely mean four people on septic system, to now include the people who are renting the basement, which is a family of four, which is now double what the septic system is designed for. They're going to be told to upgrade their septic system, as I understood you from earlier.
Correct.
So now we have these renters who have a three-bedroom residential property, which should mean six occupants in that home, as I understand the credit system for septic systems. But as this other resident of our township has observed, this rental situation, six cars are showing up, eight cars are showing up, 12 cars are showing up. So that means if 12 cars, so you have a minimum of 12 people. If there's 10 cars there, you have a minimum of 10 people. So the septic system is being abused or overused in a very intense period of time. sewage systems are designed for a two-bedroom residence, four people, and that is a constant little use all week long, all month long, all year long, and it's anticipated, and there's very little environmental impact. So when we get into the rental situation and we start allowing these things, either however it's done, the township would be able to mandate or require the owner of that property to upgrade their system to accommodate the additional renters.
Yes, if you had a licensing system, one of the things that would be a box that had to be checked off was that you had a system with sufficient capacity to handle your load. But our system is that they're not
lawful. The person, the residence is going to check off the box and say, yes, my system's going to be able to handle 10 people when it has two bedrooms in it.
No, it's done by an authority. It's done by the North Bay Mattawa Conservation Authority.
Excellent. Okay, so our township would be able to mandate that, yes, you can have this license, or yes, we will allow you to rent out your property. And the township will have the power to say, but before you can do that, or if you're doing it illegally, or if you don't have a permit, but you're still doing it, you're going to have the power to cause the Mattawa Conservation Authority to come in and assess the specific system?
No, because if you're unlawful, you risk being charged for a use that you're not zoned for.
Okay.
So that's a much more serious offense than probably the septic violation issue by itself. But before you can get there, you've got a land use violation that you're in contravention of.
Do we have that now?
Yes.
Yeah. Who enforces it?
A lot of bylaw enforcement is done by complaint, unfortunately, in small rural
Ontario. Wrong question. Who physically enforces the investigation of this violation?
I guess the bylaw enforcement officer.
Yeah, except for the septic.
Oh, yeah. That's not bylaw. That's this North Bay Health Authority.
Okay, so now we're back to my original question is, they're the authority who makes the approval. If I get a new septic system, they come in, they check me out, you can put it here, this is how big it has to be, and this is how big the tank has to be for your What I'm saying is, once that is established as to it's a sufficient use for two people, two bedrooms and four people in that home, and the renters who are renting that premise, there are six, eight people in that home when it's being rented, therefore that's a violation of something you're telling me.
Yes.
And we have that in our bylaw now.
Yes.
Now, who do we send out from our township to investigate that? And you say it's illegal. So if it's illegal, then there must be some sort of charge that can be made against the owner of the premise that's being rented out, because there's six people instead of four in there.
Yes, there's two ways that charge can unfold. One is to lay in information, and one is by ticket. My sense is that these big bucks they're getting, I don't think that the ticket would be much of a deterrent. A $500 fine for somebody that's getting $8,000 for a rental a week. But it would be the bylaw enforcement to do one of those two types of enforcement actions.
Okay. So the next question is for Reeve Mayor David Moore. Is our bylaw officer educated? Is he trained? Or is he even allowed to look into these things?
I have to check with Carter to see what courses he's taking. He is educated and he's taken various courses. The one area that we've always talked about is looking at noise, fire.
Please don't
trespass, but...
Please don't wander off my original...
No, no, okay, but just wait. The septic, I said before, through John, that no, we can't inspect that. That's North Bay Mattawa. So if that's your concern, that there are too many people there for what they should be using for the septic, that's not by law enforcement. The same as we can't control the speeds on the roads.
So we have our planner telling us that we have laws in place right now that we can enforce in regards to the septic systems. And you're saying we can't.
I don't think John said that. He can correct me if he did say that.
No, but we agree more is correct. I mean, if you feel that there is a septic violation, you can, through that office, file a complaint. And, you know, septic systems are designed that they can handle a certain amount of flow.
I understand.
And they'll blow out, if they are exceeded. So, and North Bay Mattawa will follow up.
Okay, so if I have a complaint about a septic system, I don't go to my township,
no.
I go to North Bay Mattawa.
Right.
And
that's correct.
And what power do they have to enter onto the property to inspect?
Oh, I believe they have full jurisdiction to.
So they can't stop?
No.
And if they find a violation, confirm that there's an issue there, what are they able to do?
They can actually order the property to be vacated.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which makes sense. I mean, you can't flush the toilet. Yeah. You know.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. My name? Next. Need your name?
Good evening, Your Worship, Council, Mr. Jackson. My surname is Leil, L-E-I-G-H-L, first name, Axy, A-X-Y. I'm here with David Murray. We're part of an association of, it's made up of responsible short-term rental hosts and other interested parties. We're talking entrepreneurs. The proposed changes to the zoning bylaw sort of gave us a heads up that council is looking at some form of regulation when it comes to SDRs. So we have made a written submission, and then David and I decided to appear tonight as well to kind of give you a sense of who we are. I've heard lots of disinformation tonight. David and I are, if we are not the rule, we are very typical of most of the SDRs in operation in McKellar. So we are family people, we use our cottages. Now, when I am in a little period where I'm hosting, yeah, I take some of my personal belongings out and put them in a locked closet. That's it. For the most part, this is my personal property. It's the same with Mr. Murray. So, I mean, here's the thing. We have a lot of commonalities, proponents, opponents. We love our families, we love our neighbors, we love McKellar. As a short-term rental host, I conduct myself in a way that respects my neighbors. You can go to my neighbors, and they will tell you that they have never had a problem with my guests until this past week. But I handled it, right? I ended up calling Mr. Stoneman on my own guest. Mr. Stoneman said, you know what, Maxie, I'm going to put my uniform on and I'll go down there and have a chat with them. And I said, Tom, I don't want you to chat with them. I want them written, you know, I want a ticket. He said, I can't do that. I got to give them a warning first. My neighbors tell me after Mr. Stoneman had his chat with them, they didn't hear a beep. I'm not the exception, okay? As I said, this is my personal cottage. It represents an investment to me. I take care of my septic. My fellow hosts do the same too. So, I mean, I think if we're looking at issues like septics, what do we do next? My neighbor's having a party and he's got 10, 15 people over and they're sleeping over, Doug. Do I call this authority on my neighbors?
Through the chair, please.
Another ideal that we are probably, that we all probably hold in common, regardless of your political philosophy, is, and you know, as fond as I am of my council, when it comes to governance, less is more. Right. So this is something that's kind of, I guess, adopted when we look at the rules legislation makes, or government makes. Pretty much everything government does is an infringement of some form on our rights. So we look at, you know, what is it the government is trying to achieve? Is it worthy of an infringement? And did they take the least invasive method? Right. That forces us to look at what are we trying to do here. When I was involved with the short-term rental committee, it focused on pretty much noise and open burning, you know, bad behaviors. And we looked at the data, who's contributing. It was never established that short-term rentals were actually the cause. So that's a hurdle that has to be overcome. If you're going to regulate, you know, it can't be just for the sake of regulating. Right? It can't be based on conjecture. You've got to look at what the problem is, define it, and make sure that short-term rentals are the cause of that problem. And what we've seen in, you know, some of the decisions, and something that came out of our short-term rental subcommittee, was that the best tool we have is our bylaws for enforcement. Right? Because it's not just the short-term rental guests. It's also our residents at times. So as we move forward, I urge council to take a look at that, defining what is it we want to do. Is it wipe out short-term rentals? Or is it to curb bad behavior? And are we taking the least intrusive and most efficient method to do that? I'm going to step aside and Mr. Murray will.
Mayor, board, and councilors. Prior to 2007, we owned a cottage.
Sorry, you've been introduced, but maybe you could introduce yourself.
David Murray, sorry. Prior to 2007, owning a cottage was not something that our family could do. Therefore, we rented. It was something that we taught our kids the beauty of the north, fishing, boating, and then enjoying this time spent on the lake. I'd like to speak about responsible landlord. I've been a commercial landlord. I'm an STR owner. It comes down to the aspect that we have tools in place by council to act on problems. We ask that you look after those things first before banning short-term rents. Guests need to be aware of those bylaws. And if so, sure. Probably the most important STR ownership is open communication with our neighbors. I've gone around to all my neighbors. They all know I have an STR. They come to me if there has been a problem. I've only had one time, and that was when some young lads went out in the fog on a paddle. Just being stupid. This effectively can prevent or solve issues that may arise on rare occasions. So, speaking of the absorbent money that us STR owners make, we do not. My wife and I, we donate our cottage to Kiwanis, and we've also donated our cottage to new Ukrainians coming to Canada. They have enjoyed the north and are always pleased that we have invited them up to stay on their home. We've always let them know when the burning permits were and noise violations that nothing was to be loud over 11 o'clock. I'd now like to read a letter that we received just recently from somebody who had rented our cottage. It says, "Dear Moore Council and Town Staff, I hope this letter finds you well. I'm writing to you as a long visitor perspective on the consideration as it's related to any changes to the bylaw impacting STRs and Elder. For the last 3 years, we have been privileged enough to be guests at David and Karen's cottage, and we thank them for that. We've also felt privileged enough to book our yearly vacation on Lake Manitowoc for 19 years. McKellar has been a singular location where I have had the opportunity to expose my family to the Northern Ontario. Something that everybody should have the opportunity to experience to truly expect our environment and to enjoy nature in a sustainable way. It is where I taught my son to fish, ski, hike, swim, drive a boat responsibly, and to appreciate the natural landscape of Ontario as it has to offer. Like many who visit yearly, I appeal to you for your consideration on the bias. We as a family do not see ourselves as a tourist or a visitor passing through, but as part of the community at heart. At least we respect the area as if it was our own community. Not all residents of Ontario have the means or time to be cottage owners, but through our yearly family vacation, we have made many friends and got to know operators of small businesses in the town and built memories that will last a lifetime. I also imagine the impact of a bylaw to stop STRs would impact small businesses, family investments, supplementary retirement incomes and employment, and the slowing of local economy within the sector would also need to be in deep consideration. As a family, we are grateful for every minute and memory made through our experiences in McKellar, and are thankful to the community for making us feel welcome on every visit. We hope our family can continue this, and a balance can be reached that satisfies all stakeholders with a positive income. And this was from Paul and Trace McIntyre, and they are from Niagara-on-the-Lake. Thank you.
Just ask, it's all being recorded, but if that's in writing, and that could be submitted to the township as well. And we're looking for a paper trail as well. So.
Yeah.
Thank you. Open mic here.
My name is Bill Hoddy. In regards to the Schedule A of the environmentally sensitive properties, is Schedule A just a map, or is there some documents that go along with that?
The environmentally sensitive areas, Bill, were a data file downloaded by the Ministry of Natural Resources. So the only other document would mirror those areas.
So I see on this here map, which is probably one of those, I have a copy that I got from the township here, that it has been changed over the years and it engulfs some of my properties. And I just wondered if I wanted to do any building or anything on that property, do I have to deal with having that changed? Having an amendment on that environmentally protected area?
Let me start by saying that those were actually created in the early 90s from an aircraft flying overhead, and they charted what they thought were areas with habitat features like weedy areas of aquatic vegetation. And their accuracy was very, I'm going to say, limited. So you may be one of those property owners where there can be a lot more refinement to the extent of that kind of feature. So there is a method to, one thing you can do is just tell me your property address, and I'll look at it and check it against that data source. The other thing that you can do is in the future is hire someone with the credentials to assess the appropriateness or accuracy of the extent of that natural heritage feature. But what is your address, Bill?
Lot 20, concession 9.
I'll check that from my records to make sure it's not a glitch from some other source. But there always is a possibility that the data is not accurate. And let me say that just because it is that feature, there are things that can be done, like you can place floating docks in those types of areas and that kind of thing. So it's not that it's dead land, it just has to go through a process.
Well, it's definitely not waterfront land. It's old farmland. But the original plan that I got that had environmentally protected was on the old center road to the west. Now they've moved it to the east, almost to the new center road.
Let me check the